Boy, the mincing rascals are ready to mince. This is John Williams. You know how we start this podcast each week? We introduce ourselves. Eric Zorn always goes last. He always says something to identify himself, which always takes me off of my game, and then I go there. So I told the guys before we started, I'm not going there. I'm not going to do it. Eric's going to say something, but I'm not going to do it. I have something I want to talk about. We wanted to start talking about the closing of the schools. Didn't work out the way I thought it would. You'll see. I think you're going to enjoy the conversation. Zorn gets us off on the Axios interview. Lord, the Axios interview. We do get around to the schools that are and are not opening up. And we even talk about baseball. So stick around. We got a good podcast for you. Share it with your friends, please, and email us. John Williams at WGNradio.com. Now, if you got knee pain, don't come to me. But you can take my word for it. The Joint Relief Institute is the place to go. It's true. I've been there a couple of times. Worked great for me. And not a week or two goes by that I don't hear from somebody who said, thank you for telling us about the Joint Relief Institute in Orland Park and Oak Brook. They use digital imaging to see where your knee's worn away over the years. And they put a lubricant into that spot. It works. It's like Jiffy Lube in your knee. And I'm telling you, it is a fast, non-surgical, quick, pain-free procedure that your insurance is almost surely going to pay for. The first visit's free anyway. So check them out. Their website is jointreliefinstitute.com. They've done this about 100,000 times now. The reviews are amazing. You can see those as well. Jointreliefinstitute.com. And in Orland Park or Oak Brook, it's the same phone number, 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Today is Thursday. It's August 6, 2020, the worst year ever. I'm John Williams. It's 1:36 in the afternoon, and this is The Mincing Rascals, the podcast we record throughout Chicagoland via Zoom. You can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I write the Spin Politics newsletter for the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio newsroom, and I read the Spin column.
I do, too, and I'm Eric Zorn. I'm the columnist from the Chicago Tribune who is who he is.
It is what it is.
I'm not taking the bait. I'm not taking the bait. And now I'm taking the bait.
Right.
The most outlandish, craziest interview Trump has ever given. 5 years we've been watching this guy get interviewed. The Axios one took the cake. Am I right about that?
You are. It just barely barely outstripped the one that the interview that Trump gave with Mike Wallace a couple weeks before that.
Chris Wallace.
I mean, it was really crazy, and I thought that the guy from Axios, Jonathan Swan, handled himself very well.
He was competitive, though, don't you think? I mean, I haven't seen the whole interview, but the clips I've seen, he really went after Trump in a way that's not typical.
Doesn't it make you wonder who on Trump's team tells him that this will be a good idea?
Yeah, it does.
I've been wondering that, too. I mean, I think that's the last Axios interview he does before the election.
Okay, I don't mean to always be a contrarian here, but I think that for people who maybe sort of align on that side and have the same view of the media as maybe the president does, that this could actually reinforce this view that the media is against the president, so forth. This is not taking anything away from the Axios interview. That was amazing. For anybody who's a journalist, watch that. Watch it closely. It's about doing your homework. It is about sort of having that homework memorized.
And I'm glad you said that, Lisa, because when I said he was combative, what I meant was that, well, he was aggressive in it, but he also showed a real willingness to try to understand what the president was saying. You know, when they were talking apples and oranges, he goes, oh, I see what you're saying here. Well, that shouldn't count, or things like that.
Take a look at some of these charts.
I'd love to.
Well, right here, the United States is lowest in numerous categories. We're lower than the world.
Lower than
we're
the
lower
world?
Lower than what is that? Europe.
In so what? Look. In what?
Take a look.
I agree. And I think that there is a sort of there's a stream of consciousness with the president that Jonathan could kind of sort of duck and weave with. You have to kind of do that with him. And I think that the president likes to debate. Jonathan was able to go with that. I wasn't saying you weren't being fair at all, Steve. I just meant like
no.
Really, really did his homework, stuck to the facts, rode the middle line, but then challenged him on these questions, especially on the coronavirus statistics.
Right here. Here's case death.
oh, you're doing death as a proportion of cases. I'm talking about death as a proportion of population. That's where the U.S. is really bad.
Well,
much worse than South Korea, Germany, etc.
You can't do that. You have
Why
to go,
can't I do that?
Which it went off the map.
It was the Wallace interview too, both times in the Exodus interview with Swan, that the president kind of looked off to his right, like, what the hell's going on here? You know, and he was asking for a charge or asking for help. You could know, you know, his people were over there, and I'm sure they got an earful when it was over.
His showed COVID deaths over cases, and Jonathan Swan was more interested in COVID deaths over the population. Mm-hmm. So we reached out to this guy named Aaron Bromage, who is this comparative immunologist. And this is a positive takeaway. This is why, Lisa, I think the interview was so valuable. It wasn't just, I don't like Trump. Let me see if I can box him in a corner. So this professor comes on. He told us, God bless you for the cases, but that really doesn't matter.
In reality, when you look at the number of fatalities as a percentage of our population, we are doing terribly compared to the rest of the world. So they're both important, but one spins a narrative that is not really correct in what's relevant of how many of your citizens are being infected and how many are dying.
Yes, and I mean, in fairness to the president, I think what he's trying to say is that we are doing a better job than most countries in treating the cases that we have identified. Now, of course, it's a little bit skewed by the fact that we do test a lot. So you are going to get a lot of these cases. And I certainly have known people who have had positive tests and have very, very few symptoms. And we see them in politics now all the time. You see someone who gets, or in sports, you'll see someone who's diagnosed and then they're back. And there's never any story about how they were lingering near death. But it does seem like our healthcare system is doing a better job than most around the world in treating the cases that are identified, maybe. But I agree with the basic thrust of the argument, which is that it's deaths per population that is really the telling statistic. And I think we are, what, in the fourth worst in the world right now?
Why is that the distinctive figure?
The problem with the cases is that when you're comparing countries and the aggressiveness of their testing, you can't be sure that it's an apples-to-apples comparison there. But deaths are pretty much deaths. I know people like to say, oh, they're putting COVID deaths into the wrong category. And some people say that the COVID deaths are underreported. Some say they're overreported. But I think in general, we get a pretty good sense that, you know, more than 150,000 Americans have died from this virus. And that is a shameful statistic. And that's one that's hard to talk your way out of.
Right? It's one Swan hit on when he said, okay, apples to apples. If we were South Korea.
Well, look at South Korea, for example, 51 million population, 300 deaths. It's like, it's
you,
crazy.
You don't know that.
I do. It's
you
on
don't
the,
know
it's
that.
Not, you think they're faking their statistics? South Korea?
I won't get into
country?
That because I have a very good relationship with the country. But you don't know that.
50 million people, if you multiplied then their population by six, you would get to our population. If you multiplied their deaths by six, you would get to about 1,800. What's our death rate? It's been
nearly 160,000 at this point.
But let's skip to the front now that Eric is thoroughly dear. I want to talk about the Chicago public schools and, for that matter, the Catholic schools in Chicago. The CPS schools are closed and will not reopen until at least the second week of November. The CPS has caved in to science, not pressure from the union, they say. The Tribune said in its editorial that it is a mistake. And Darlene Glanton, who joins us frequently in this podcast, wrote a wrenching piece about the kids left on the sidelines. I may quote from it here in a little bit, but let's just all start with what was our news click at the radio station. Did CPS make the right decision, Lisa, in deciding to wait until the second week of November?
I can't weigh in on that as a journalist, but I will say it just kind of looks bad. I mean, here we're talking about, so we're going to go through this thorough process and really have the parents weigh in. And Tuesday morning, you have the public health commissioner for the city. This is a Mayor Lightfoot appointee saying, you know what? I think if things keep going the way they are now, sure, we can have in-class learning. She says she believes it's good for the mental health of the kids, et cetera, et cetera. And then as the day progresses, we hear that the union is going to is taking these very first baby steps toward perhaps authorizing a sick strike, as it were, to strike, because they are very concerned that the outbreak is so large that it's not safe for teachers, for kids, et cetera. And so, like an hour after that, we get word from Chicago Public Schools, and remember, the board and the CEO are appointed by the mayor, saying, we're gonna scrap this whole planning session, and we're just gonna do remote learning. You can't get up there as a public official, as the governor, as the mayor, and say we're gonna let the science guide us, when in fact it really feels like a kind of a knuckling under, and that there are plenty of parents struggling out there. You know, they have to work. They can't leave their kids home. They're too little to stay alone. What are they going to do? This is such a, I know there's some plan B's and C's out there, but this is just.
Well, I'll tell you what I think the right answer is. And that's when you look at these poll numbers that they got back. CPS released survey results. They got 68,000 parents. Only 20% of Black and Latino parents said they would send their kids to school. Right. 50% of white parents said they would. And then just overall, 41% of elementary school parents and 38% of high school parents said they would refuse to send their children back to school in the next coming weeks. And when you have a situation like that, you have chaos. You're going to have school that if you're doing it in person and they're not going to be there, then I don't think that this is just knuckling under to the teachers threatening to strike. I understand what the teachers were about. I mean, I'm trying to put myself into this position. I mean, I'm of an age where I would be vulnerable if I had a classroom full of runny-nosed kids going around, maybe carrying the virus to me and to my family. I don't think these teachers, I mean, there's this urge to paint the teachers as these selfish, entitled,
no, that's not cats. I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's a bad look if it appears to be sort of, you're going to have this message of we're following the science, and then there's this battle, and then are you really following the science? I'm not painting the teachers, and I don't mean to. If I did that, I apologize.
Eric, I want to go back to your numbers, because what's fascinating to me is I live in Deerfield, and I'm going to make this up a little bit, but I think that they surveyed the parents there, and I think 80% of the parents wanted in-classroom learning. And I know there was at least one other suburb where they asked the parents, and it was overwhelmingly in support of in-class learning. And here we are in the city, where presumably the income is lower and the need to get to work is higher. And maybe the availability of daycare is lower, but the numbers are reversed. More parents want to keep their kids home. What do you make of that?
Well, I thought it was very interesting that it was 20% of Black and Latino parents. Only 20% wanted to send their kids back. And I think that's in part a realization that this virus, this disease, is striking these poor and minority communities much harder than it's striking some of these communities. Like my community, yeah. For instance, you know, I mean, I am able to work at home. I haven't taken the L in almost 4 months. I don't have to have that exposure. I'm not an essential worker, although my column is essential reading. I do want to understand. there is a certain privilege that is associated with being able to avoid this virus the way that some of these poorer communities can't. I think that explains some of it. But I understand. I don't have school age kids anymore. But I know how I would have been really torn by, first of all, just, you know, the childcare problem that's associated with it, but also the fact that all these studies show that school is really good for kids. It's good to socialize them. It's good to, you know, it stimulate them. They can't sit in front of a screen all day getting Zoom lessons and have the same sort of benefit that they need.
The teachers union, Jesse Sharkey.
Yeah, president.
What was the phrase, Steve, that we asked him if he wanted to stand by?
She didn't have the guts.
She did not have the guts to close the schools. And I didn't think that was helpful rhetoric. I asked him if he wanted to amend that just before they knuckled under.
Well, maybe I should have said the political courage, but yeah, I want to stay with it. The fact of the matter is that the mayor of the city has spent a decent amount of political capital talking about how the city is going to reopen. Now the contagion rates are getting worse, across the state, but in the city as well. And I think the conclusion that she should be drawing is to turn around and reverse what she said earlier about in-person learning beginning the school year.
But, you know, on that in that same interview, John, and I brought this up with you, he later said almost like the city is afraid to make the decision and they're going to force us to make it.
Yeah.
And that was that fateful day when later they leaked that they were going to be meeting the next week. So, I mean, I think all along the teachers were not going to report back to school, and either that or they got wind that the city was changing its plans and made themselves look tougher by saying they weren't.
Well, it could be both, right? It could be that the science is changing or the numbers were changing and that they were getting pressure from the union and a lack of interest from the parents themselves.
The numbers are clearly going up in Illinois and in Chicago.
But isn't that sort of what Anthony Fauci goes through sometimes? The president likes to remind you that he wasn't real concerned about masks. COVID-19 first hit, and then Fauci says, yeah, and then we got smarter, or the virus changed, or the science is evolving for us on this. So as things change, I think it's okay for the schools to at one point say, yeah, we want hybrid learning, and then segue to a different view, which is, no, we can't have that. That's just having your ears open, right?
No, I think it is.
Well, you asked earlier, you started with CPS and Catholic schools, and, you know, we didn't get to the Catholic schools yet, but I think I'm showing the wisdom at this point to realizing I have no idea what the right answer is. I mean, I'm serious. Someone asked me what they should do, and I have no, I don't think there's a good choice. And so it's like, what is the less bad choice? And I don't know which one it is at this point.
Well, I totally second that feeling. Not only do I feel like I don't have any idea what the right course of action is in terms of like sports and schools and all this other stuff. I don't even know what I would do if I had a 7-year-old, if I had a 14-year-old. I don't know if I would send them to school. It feels like it changes every day. And this virus seems to have made a fool out of anybody who has said, oh, it's going to go away, or it's no big deal, or just any prediction that anybody ever makes. It's also made a fool of people who said that we'd have 2 million people in the U.S. possibly die. I mean, it's one of those things we can't predict it. I think we have to be cautious and we have to be very humble.
No one said we'd have 2 million people in this. Now you're reading the president's copy.
No, they did. There was a projection out of England that was
if we don't test.
Yes, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. But there are projections that were all over the place about this. Humility is a really good point to take, and also, I think that this thing with Catholic schools is going to be really interesting because we're going to see a test basically run in real time. How are the Catholic schools going to do it? And I certainly hope that they do really well and that in retrospect, Mayor Lightfoot made the wrong decision and that the CPS made the wrong decision. I think everybody hopes that it goes off well and not many kids get sick. I doubt it, but again, you have to hope that, but I don't think anyone can predict. And I think that the Catholic schools are taking a big risk here.
I think that they are, but I also wonder whether you see smaller class sizes. I don't know that you see the population in some of the Catholic schools that you might see in some of the CPS classrooms. And with that smaller population, smaller number of kids in each class, you may have more success in, you know, social distancing and so forth. But, you know, with little kids, there's just no way in kindergartners, there's just no way to sort of enforce that. So,
well, we've seen the pictures out of the Georgia high school, right? All the kids jammed into hallways and you see 3 masks out of like 70 kids.
Yeah.
We saw the same story out of Georgia about the overnight camp, the YMCA camp, that said they were going to have all these safety precautions in place. And
we can't keep Major League Baseball players from putting their arms around each other.
Yeah.
You know, they're in the dugout maskless. Now, I know I think a mask mandate just went into effect for the dugouts now. But, you know, you got these ball players making millions of dollars without a mask on in the dugout talking to each other, you know, cheek to jowl.
Actually, I don't find it relaxing. I was really hoping that, oh, okay, baseball. I don't find it relaxing. I'm like, oh, God.
So you're watching baseball. Finally, we get baseball, and all you see is people not wearing masks.
No, I'm just sort of worried about them. I just don't want anybody to get this thing. It feels stressful to me.
Hey, also, survivor. You're talking to a survivor here. You know,
John had it.
Yeah, okay.
I really think we're going to find out that not that we all had it, certainly, but that it is so much more widespread than we have any idea. And so many people are going to be like John that had, you know, minor symptoms. DeWine says he's feeling nothing. Rodney Davis downstate says, you know, he's not feeling anything. Mm-hmm. If he didn't take his temperature, he would have never known. And his temperature is only 99 degrees.
Right.
I wonder if some of these cases like Louis Gohmert and Rodney Davis and DeWine – are these false positives? I mean, these tests aren't perfect, right?
Right, right. And DeWine's going back to Columbus, he said, to get another test. So
they say they're pretty. I mean, you know, I don't know who the they is. When I got my test, I asked, mine was an antibody test, right? Not a COVID test, but I asked about that. And those were more suspect in the manufacturer. This is Northwestern Hospital administering it, and they said they felt it was 99.6% accurate, my test.
Yeah.
And I was symptomatic, so, you know, after the fact, I realized that month later, I realized I probably had it. But
it's among the things that we just don't know about this virus is why it seems to attack some people really severely and others kind of shake it off. And it's, as the president puts it, like a bad cold or the sniffles or something like that. There really are people who are asymptomatic carriers, and they're asymptomatic when they are technically sick with it, and then it's gone. And they don't know that about the virus. They don't know what about the immune system does that for some people and not for others. There's a very interesting article in The Atlantic by a guy, last name is Yang, who talks about immunology and what we know and what we don't know about it. And it's very sobering to realize that even, you know, where we are in medical science, we just don't know a lot of stuff about something as small and aggressive as a virus.
Speaking of reading magazine articles about this, did you all see the Vanity Fair piece that suggested that the administration led by Jared Trump sort of reined in a national campaign, you know, masks, testing, contact tracing? They reined that in because they realized from the outset it would favor blue states.
Well, so she said that the idea is that it was blue states that are suffering from this, so we don't need to work so hard on a national strategy, because in the end, the Democratic leaders are the ones that are going to look bad.
Kushner had a team that came up with a strategy, and they thought that the president was going to roll it out. And then at the last minute, the whole thing was poofed. It just went away.
You read the story. You talked to her. She did not say directly, though, that Jared Kushner killed it, right? She said that Jared Kushner oversaw the development of it and implied that he might have killed it.
Well, it did go away, and it was his committee, right? She wasn't in the room, but she sure makes it sound like if Jared Kushner or Donald Trump wanted us to have the plan that, in fact, they formulated that would have helped, it would have happened. The president or Jared decided that it's not going to happen. It's not that they didn't do the work. In fact, they came up with a plan for contact tracing. We never did it.
And those people worked to guide the group towards a bankable national plan. And that was never implemented. They expected it to be implemented, and it never was.
It would have been very on brand for the Trumps to do something like that. That's all I'll say. I don't know. You know, contact tracing, I'm skeptical about that because of the length of time it's taking to get some of these tests back, and the way so many people are so suspicious of anybody who works for authority. So if someone comes to your house and knocks on the door and says, hey, we got this pandemic going, and you know, you have this disease, who have you been in touch with? And you know, half the people are going to say none of your business and slam the door, because it's calling people, right? They see a number on their phone, they don't recognize, they hang up. I mean, I feel like our country is just not built for this kind of.
And I tried to make the point. Go ahead, Eric. I'm sorry.
Epidemic tracing. I think that constitutionally, we are not the kind of people who are going to be easily following the rules that you need to follow to bring a pandemic like this to heal.
Well, I think in 20 or 30 years from now, when the book is written on this, there's going to be a chapter on the influence of the collapse of our institutions and how it made it worse. And I kind of tried to bring that point up a few weeks ago. But, you know, we've absolutely lost faith in government, faith that we had decades ago. Faith in institutions like the religion or other things. We've stopped believing in people telling us anything. We're suspect of all of that. And I think that has made this worse. I think that is going to be part of the story one day.
Okay, but if Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi, arm in arm, stood on Capitol Hill and in May said, everybody cooperate with contact tracing, wear masks, right? I mean, Steve, you're talking about the collapse of institutions, but if they had done that, do you think people would have rallied around that we would have been smarter about?
Well, we would have been smarter, yeah, but I think there still would be a significant number of the people who would say, we're not going to let the government tell us we're going to keep the government out of our Medicare. You know, we're not going to let the government tell us what to do, and so we're not going to do it. I don't know. What do you think of that, Eric?
I think that if Trump had had led on this, that there's a significant percentage of people who either they don't trust government, they trust Donald Trump, and they would have worn masks and they would have accepted some of this, the closures and the distancing requirements a lot more easily if Trump had been really out there leading the way. That he was actually uniquely positioned to do that. That if it had been President Hillary Clinton telling them to wear masks or closing down their hair salons, you would have seen the exact same kind of level of outrage. But I do think that Trump has a certain sway among a certain segment of people who have this, don't tell me what to do about anything attitude.
Which is an American
disposition. And I think people would go there are people, I mean, read your Twitter feed. I mean, if he had gotten up and said that, you probably would have had a whole backlash of lefties saying, no way, I'm not going to do that. He doesn't know what he's doing. I'm not going to listen to that. I believe that absolutely would happen.
Well,
people are so unreasonable about politics right now. I mean, just the stupid things that I get in my inbox. I think there'd be a whole wave of people like, well, if Trump said it, I'm not going to do it. So.
Yeah, but Nancy Pelosi was on the Capitol Hill steps in that scenario, and Anthony Fauci was there too. And who else can I throw in? The Pope. I mean, if these
Michael Moore
up with people, they were singing in the background.
Steve's worried about we've lost faith in institutions, but maybe institutions have lost faith in us. When have we had any united front coming from our government saying, hey, everybody, let's all pull together? They never do.
I would say 2001. Yeah. The September 10th phenomenon, right? Or September 12th. I'm sorry.
September 11th.
September 11th, but the day the day after phenomenon where everybody on my block, I live on the northwest side, everybody in my block put an American flag out on their front porch with almost no exceptions. And it's just like you never see that, because even in our neighborhood, which is not particularly politically fraught, there was just this incredible outpouring of patriotism and the sense that we were all in this together, we're all in this international fight. And John, you say that, when was the last time? I think that was it. And then it started to fade on September 13th, and it's
right. Yeah, I think it was
a wave of it, sort of a civility. I almost feel like this is the stuff I read in history books that it's never happened in my lifetime.
Getting back to the September 11th, Eric, one of the things, and this is a aggravating remembrance of mine, I think most people might remember it fondly, but when you had the members of the Congress standing on the steps of the Congress singing, and they were turning over this new leaf that they couldn't hold for 6 weeks or 8 weeks. You had the crap scared out of you, and you promised to change, and then you couldn't hold. You couldn't do it for us. You couldn't do it.
The scene I remember most vividly was George Bush with the bullhorn at the rubble.
Thousands of our citizens. I can hear you. I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people who knock these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
Did he say it is what it is? Or
there we go.
And we're back to the Axios interview. So J.B. Pritzker said, let me finish this thought about how we're not getting sufficient leadership, maybe. Who is behind this promotional campaign in Illinois to get everybody to wear masks and say distance? Is that the governor's office, right?
The governor's office, yes.
And you guys, before we opened our microphones here or whatever, we're poo-pooing the idea. I don't think a well-orchestrated public service campaign is a bad idea. Why do you guys not like the sound of that?
I don't like the sound of it because it seems like it's $5 million that could be going toward, any kind of beneficial program for people, could be going to any sorts of things that could really help society. And $5 million seems like a waste to tell people something that they obviously should do.
Maybe they could have found some good corporate sponsor to pay for this. I'm not against the mass campaign. It's fine. I just want to see that money go to helping people. People are really suffering.
What is the slogan? It won't work if you don't wear it.
It only works if you wear it.
Always wear a mask when you're out in public to protect yourself and others.
Well, it just seems like it was a 1980s sex ed campaign for high school boys.
And they dusted it off. You know, I mean, how did we learn to wear seatbelts or smoking? Or listen, I work at a radio station that lives on advertising and clever campaigns. And I think if your goal is important enough to get people to stop smoking or wear seatbelts or stop spreading COVID, no amount of money is poorly spent on that if it works.
I'm not against the campaign. I'm saying that the money, I wish it could have come from some kindly corporate donor, maybe somebody who's a billionaire. Yeah.
John is right about public service announcements in a way. I think that they really did help with things like seatbelts, and they help with the smoking campaign. Those things take a long time to settle in for people. And I don't know that my personal ideas, I think they should start fining people who are not wearing masks in situations where they have to wear them.
I do too.
and I know it'd be really unpopular. Maybe make them do some public service if they don't want to pay the fine. But that we really have to make sure that people are taking this seriously and are not thinking that this is just some sort of a wimpy request. That you really have to do this. I'd like it so that stores are empowered and don't let people inside who don't wear masks. And if people barge their way in, that the police should come and find them. I mean, we really have to crack down on this, because I think that it is the only way we're going to get out of it.
We're inching back up. Steve Bertrand, do you like the idea of $75 tickets? Police jump out of the bushes and write you one if you don't have your mask on.
I just don't think that's very feasible. I don't know how you can do it. I mean, maybe we should just take pictures of people and turn them into text them to 311 or something. I'd be interested in cracking down on businesses that don't strictly enforce it. I know we're asking business to do a lot these days, but I've been in places where guys come in without a mask and it works for them. They buy their, Diet Coke at the gas station and they walk out. If there was someone at the gas station saying, I'm not going to sell that to you unless you wear a mask, that might change behavior.
No, yeah, shirts, put the onus. Shoes, no masks, no service.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we put the onus on businesses when they're trying to sell alcohol. Yeah, you might get a ticket for buying it, but it's the business that will really suffer if they serve it to a minor. So maybe it should be more on the businesses.
John, that's a great idea. I like that idea a lot. I'd love to let you in, but I risk a $100 fine or a $150 fine if a customer is in my store without a mask, so I can't do it. I think that's a great idea, John. I'll vote.
Is he being sarcastic?
No, I'm not. Not at all.
I don't know, because I thought it was my idea, but.
Well, if it was Steve's idea, then I don't know.
Steve?
I think that turning the situation around and putting it on the store owners really would change the way the store owner reacts to customers coming in. Because I think a lot of store owners think it's kind of stupid, too.
Let me tell you, I was in Michigan a couple weeks ago, in northern Michigan, where Traverse City area, and they were pretty observant there. But we were in this one shop, and the woman who ran it had this little kitschy sort of overpriced stuff. She had these signs on the door saying, by regulation here, I have to have this mask on. You have to have the mask. And, was clearly hostile to it by what she posted. We went in, we were in there for 15 minutes, and the shop owner never wore her mask, which was shocking to me. So, yeah, she should be fined.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not just – so thank you for the support. But I'm not concerned just about people in stores. I mean, I just think it would make it easy for society and for the police and everybody if they said, if you're more than 6 feet outside your door, and if you go 30 seconds after being approached to wear a mask and you don't, then you will get a ticket. I mean, even if you're walking across the Michigan Avenue Bridge by yourself, if I come up to you with my little ticket pad, I'd like you to wear a mask, and within 30 seconds, if you don't produce one and put it on, I give you a $50, $70 ticket.
But John, even the guidance we're getting from the experts right now is that if you're walking across the Michigan Avenue Bridge by yourself, there's no reason for you to wear a mask. So your rules would make it stricter than we need. And I think that would only create more rebellion.
That indoor spaces is, seems to be clearly the problem, right?
I go on early morning bike rides and I do pull the mask down. I have a route that's sort of, I don't see very many people. It's very early. And it's hard to cycle and have a mask on. It's from Edgewater to Wrigley to to Diversey. Anyway,
I ride every morning too.
Oh, okay. All right. I'll meet up with you, but I will have a mask on. But I do have a mask at the ready for those joggers who are in the street going the wrong way. So I'm prepared for it, but I do take it off.
Let me ask you guys this: how are you going to vote? I presume you can tell me that. And what do you make of J.B. Pritzker's? You will not be required to wear a mask in the polling place. If you don't want to, for whatever reason, you won't have to. Are you going to vote by mail? And what do you make of not having to wear a mask in the polling place?
I am going to vote by mail. I've already registered. And as I've said on the show before, I have somebody in my household with a respiratory condition. So just sort of out of an abundance of caution.
Johanna and I were just talking about this today. Neither of us really trust the mail quite enough yet to vote by mail. We also want to make sure that our votes count on election day so that they know about it. So I think both of us are planning to go early vote. I've early voted in most elections in the last few years, and I find it to be very easy and not at all crowded. I've never had to stand in line for more than like 3 minutes at early voting, and that feels safe enough to me. I don't particularly like voting at the precinct because there can be lines there. But mail-in voting, I'm a little bit leery of still. I'm just not sure what the Postal Service is going to be doing.
I've never run into real long lines in my particular precinct. And I just get a charge out of being part of the process on election day. So I think I will vote in person on Tuesday.
Well, I want to be part of the thing, so I'm going to go ahead and vote by mail. I've already registered to get a ballot, and now wait and see what that's like.
But to your other point, though, none of us answered is the mask thing. I'm not sure I get the fact that you could vote without a mask.
Yeah, that's kind of strange. Well, they don't want to suppress the vote. So if you can't wear a mask or won't wear a mask, it's probably more important that you vote than you not vote.
We can't share a CVS line, though, with mask wearers and non-mask. Can you imagine being in a polling place?
Isn't there the caveat that if you have a medical condition, you do not have to wear that would make it difficult for you to breathe, that you don't have to wear these masks. So you could be in line with somebody at CVS without a mask.
Has anybody met a person that literally has a medical condition so severe that they can't wear a mask in public? I mean, I hear about that, and some of these people have shouted that at the stores. But really, I want to meet that person.
I'm sure there are some people who have asthma conditions or COPD conditions that make it difficult to wear a mask. I think that those people, though, given the circumstances, ought to have a doctor's note with them, or there ought to be the same way you get a handicapped placard for your car. Want to park in a special spot, that you need to have some sort of a state ID or some sort of documentation with you to do that. And that would discourage people, because I think a lot of people who are claiming that don't have any condition at all, and they just don't want to wear a mask.
Right.
How happy are you guys that sports are back? You can watch the NBA in the bubble, the NHL playoffs. The Blackhawks, as we record this, are doing really well. The Cubs and White Sox are playing really well. Is it changing your world at all?
We know Lisa's worried about their health, so it's aggravating for her.
You really are.
Well,
I really am. At first, I was like, yes, the Sox are on. Sox fan. And I was so excited. And then the more the discussions went on, and then I think that was the Sox Cubs game, actually, that series. And then sort of when the digital people, were added into the whole scenario, then they're gone. And that's weird. And there was more and more discussion about COVID and, okay, this player has it and that player has it and this team's opting out. I was just sort of like, oh my God, it is not the diversion and the distraction. I guess I could put it on mute, but that's part of it, is sort of listening to the play-by-play. So I don't know. No, it's not relaxing to me.
I love it. The fact that there are the stands are empty, I thought would be an issue for me. It hasn't been an issue for me at all. I've watched more baseball in the first week of this season than I probably did in the first 6 weeks of last season.
It does help, though, that the local teams are doing really well.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they're just the Cubs are on fire. And I haven't seen more than like a little bit of one game because my TV provider does not have the Marquee Network or NBC Sports Chicago, which has the White Sox. So I am out of luck when it comes to watching those sports. And I found that I'm doing okay with that. I don't mind missing. I'm watching some of the NBA on ESPN and enjoying that some. But again, I've never really followed the NBA season until the playoffs because it just feels like a lot of ground pawing all year. And I am enjoying watching the return of professional golf. I know that's a real popular thing, but I really like watching the last day of a tournament, and the PGA tournament is this weekend. I'll be glued to it. And I think that's fun. I don't miss the crowds there at all. In fact, I don't think I even really notice that the crowds aren't there.
In golf?
Yeah. Well,
I've watched a little bit of, or a lot of, every single White Sox game, every single Cubs game, every single Blackhawks game.
You're good.
I find myself still a little disturbed by them generating fake noise. So when somebody hits a home run, the crowd goes woo, and there's no crowd there. So it's still just a little disjointed to me. I've even added taping Formula One racing from around the world.
No, you haven't. Really?
That you'll knock it till you tried it. You know, they had that Netflix series.
I have tried it and I will knock it. Thank you.
This is America, damn it. We watched that Netflix docuseries, Drive to Survive. Netflix, it's about the International Grand Prix Circuit. It's fascinating. Half-hour episodes. And each one tells the story of these teams, Mercedes and Ferrari and Red Bull and McLaren. And I'll tell you what, the biggest stars in sports in the world aren't from America. They're soccer stars in Europe and they're Formula One drivers from all around the world. It's fascinating. Anyway, so we kind of got into it. And now Sunday mornings, we tape the thing because it's on like at 5 a.m. Or something like that. And I watch it a little later in the day, and it's
when you say we, John, Brenda's not part of this, is she?
She is, because the drivers are adorable.
Okay, all right.
And she's as much of a sports person as I am.
Look, they're turning left again. They're turning left. I can't believe it.
Yeah, but they're doing it at 200 miles an hour, Eric. Oh. So one last thing. And I only bring this up because, Lisa, you were kind of clicking around on this today doing your job. Kanye West's desire to run for president and get on the ballot in Wisconsin, Ohio, maybe Illinois. I think it's kind of a tragic story. I think we're watching the slow mental breakdown of a guy who has always seemed to have some mental health issues to me. I was willing to write his presidential campaign off at first as just a promotional stunt to push his new album, but I don't think it's that. And I think it's sad. I don't know that it'll be consequential in the election. Does he take votes from Donald Trump? Does he take black votes from Joe Biden? I don't know. But
in looking around, there seems to be a narrative going on right now. Some people digging in other states. I'm trying to dig around here in Illinois to see what's going on. But in Wisconsin, he had an attorney submit his filing application and petitions. And that attorney is an attorney who's tied to a number of Republican campaigns and is currently representing President Trump in some kind of litigation up there. I believe it's a libel case. And then in Colorado, a similar situation. And the New York Times came out and said that there's a feeling that Kanye West is not only getting Republicans to help him file, but that they may be even Trump allies. Now, President Trump was asked during a press conference, very straightforward yesterday, are you encouraging him to run, or are you encouraging Republicans to help him get on the ballot?
Mr. President, at least two people connected to Kanye West's effort to get on the ballot have been connected to the Republican Party. Is this
whose ballot?
Kanye West.
With Kanye
West? He's getting on the ballot, including in swing states. And as you know, his wife has raised issues about whether he's having mental issues right now. So my question to you is, are you aware of any of the efforts?
Kanye West.
Are you aware of, or have you encouraged anyone in the party to help him get on the ballot, including in swing states?
No, not at all. No, not at all. Other than I get along with him very well. I like him. I like his wife.
That alone, that answer alone is interesting in my mind because Kanye, when he announced at the beginning of July, I'm running, 4th of July announcement, I'm running. I'm taking off the red cap, you know, a sign that he's not with Trump anymore, kind of disavowing him. And usually that draws a little bit of fire from the president. He's not going to take somebody criticizing him publicly like that. He stood down. He hasn't said anything. And instead calls him a friend. So I think that that is sort of fueling a lot of the speculation, too. And Kanye was asked by Forbes in a fairly long kind of strange interview about, hey, you know, you could be diverting, you could be siphoning off black votes that Biden has. What do you think of that? And I do think that he has a point. He went after the interviewer and says, look, you're acting like we're a monolith. And that, you know, that view that Democrats own the black vote, that's racist, too. I don't care. So there's a lot of discussion about sort of, I think there's some hints and suggestions like, oh, are the Republicans really trying to aid and abet this campaign somehow? Does it reach up to the White House? And is he doing it to knock Biden out? I don't know. I'm not sure. And I agree with you on a personal level. His behavior is concerning. So
I think that Republicans are trying to help him and that it's shameful that they're taking advantage of this guy's mental illness, because that's what's going on here. Kanye West is admittedly mentally ill.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get him on the ballot because they believe in their cynical and racist way that they're going to get black voters to vote for him instead of Joe Biden. I don't think it's going to work. And I think it's shameful.
I wonder what the ethics are going to be like and the campaign ads we're going to be seeing between now and November 3rd or whatever.
Well, the idea is going to be to portray Biden as being demented, basically. That's the idea is to make it look like he suffers from dementia and can't be president. And I think that, and I've said this before, I think that they are setting the bar so low that if Biden comes onto the debate stage, and I was rewatching some of his debate with Bernie Sanders, and he did fine. And he'll do fine in a debate against Trump. He's not going to drool in his shoes or wander off the stage like he's confused. They're trying to make it look like Biden is incompetent, and that's not going to work. But we're going to see that hammered on. We're going to see Hunter Biden stories, a lot of those. We're going to see, you know, eyebrows being raised about China, and the problem with that is going to be that there's so much corruption, so much grifting going on in the Trump administration that the point to Hunter Biden or something would happen in China is just completely beside the point. I don't think that's going to work either. The other thing you're going to see a lot from the Republicans, I think, is going to be, and we've already seen some ads like this, like you're going to see these protesters and pulling down statues and saying this is Joe Biden's America, and Joe Biden sides with the squad, and he sides with the far left of his party. He's going to be their puppet. I don't think any of these approaches are going to have much purchase with people who are just sick of this current administration and want to change.
Well, there's a commercial that shows. Go ahead, Lisa.
I was watching this webinar yesterday, actually Rahm Emanuel sort of doing his sort of crystal ball thing. And I write about that today too, saying that Trump really believes that he is setting a path on the way to this last stretch of the campaign of like, this is 1968 again. And you have me, the normal conservative versus the hippies, protesters who are out of their minds. And they're lawless. And so I'm trying to sort of rein everything in and have some order, you know, the whole law and order thing. And Rahm Emanuel's point, and he does know a thing or two. He's worked in two White Houses. He ran Bill Clinton's financial part of his campaign back in 92. He says that this should be more viewed as sort of a 1980 type of campaign where you are going to see that people are past that no, we're not going to even vote on our party line here. And that just as sort of there were Reagan Democrats, he believes that there are going to be a ton of Biden Republicans.
Well, there already are, the Lincoln Project people. And just to refresh anybody's memory, if it wasn't around in 1980, that was when Jimmy Carter was running for re-election.
Right.
And we had the whole the problem with the hostage crisis, and his popularity had really fallen because of the way he handled that situation. I'm not sure that a lot of that second guessing is merited. And in hindsight, Jimmy Carter seems like it's a pretty fine pretty fine person, but there was this appetite for change, and there was this feeling like this president we have now just isn't up to the job. He's failed at some critical matters, and we want something new. And Reagan projected a lot of optimism. And I think what you're going to see from Biden, what you're already seeing from Biden, is not a starry-eyed optimism, but a sense like we can bring decency back to this country. We're gonna bring this country back from pull it back from the abyss in which and Trump has taken it. So yeah, I think 1980 is probably a much better analogy.
Well, and the age factor was the age thing was a factor in that election too. Carter, I didn't vote. I was a kid then, but Carter really went after the age thing with Reagan, and it failed hugely because then, as now, the largest voting bloc there are seniors, and so this whole thing of Trump sort of painting Biden as being too old now may very well fall flat too. Again, you have people who are like, "Hey, I'm a senior citizen. What are you talking about him being too old?" And also, there's concern in that block about how Trump has responded to COVID. So I it'll be interesting.
Trump took a test to see whether he is suffering from dementia. I mean, he's no spring chicken either. Not exactly the
understood. I don't know that went to his age, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So, but I think the basic answer to John's question is it's going to be really ugly. The next 3 months are going to be extremely.
What do you make then? What do you make then, Eric, of the commercial that shows Joe Biden sitting on the floor to some empty furniture, like in a basement, which is where the Trump campaign is rhetorically putting him on all of these issues. And then you see the actual video from which that image was taken. Is it somebody's living room where they were having one of these meet the candidate things? And he's casually sitting on the floor and people are on the sofas and all crowded around. They photoshopped everybody out, though, and sort of doctored the image to make him look pathetic and alone in a basement. I think you'll see worse on both sides as we get closer to voting day.
Well, again, I mean, I get back as I think that when you set expectations so low, the idea that they're trying to sell is that Biden is, you know, John Cass's column the other day, he says, oh, he's in his basement eating pudding. That's just not the case. And if you wanted, I mean, what worked with Hillary Clinton was saying like, oh, Hillary Clinton, she's a college debater. She's so smart. She's going to, you know, but if Donald Trump doesn't start gibbering, he'll win the debate. That was how the Trump campaign, the Republicans set the expectations low for Trump. And when he exceeded those, they were able to say that he did okay in the debates. Biden's going to show up. Biden's going to do fine. You know, is he going to say some goofy stuff? Yeah, but so is Trump. Is he going to pronounce Yosemite as Yosemite? Probably not. You know, I mean, these guys make little mistakes like that. And I just don't think that's going to sell as long as Biden doesn't do something extremely weird.
Be good for all of us, I think, if they do fewer debates closer to the election. The president wants more debates and he wants them before people get a chance to mail in their ballots. He wants to try and undermine Biden's credibility as soon as possible, knowing that people will be voting early.
See, I think Biden's campaign strategy so far has been brilliant. Trump has just been talking himself into hole after hole, and Biden has been just, you know, issuing statements and making a few virtual appearances. But why would he go out there when Trump is just immolating like he is? I think maybe an answer for Biden could say, well, you know what? I know it's a custom for us to debate, but it's also a custom for candidates to reveal their income tax returns. So I tell you what, you reveal your income tax returns and I'll debate you as much as you want. or I'll give you five debates, whatever you want, and see, you know what, you play that game if you're going to play the expectation. There's nothing that says that you have to debate. There were no debates at all in presidential elections before 1960. I think for like 100 years or something, it wasn't obligatory until then. And I think that you could easily just say, and there are plenty of elections in this country where the candidates don't debate because one candidate feels like he doesn't need to debate because of that support. I think a candidate with the kind of lead that Biden has in a normal election would say, I don't need to debate you. Voters know where I stand. Why would I put myself up for that?
And there's not the need for debates that there used to be, right? That used to be a way to convey information and see these people under some duress and how they handle it. With media now, the 24/7 news channels, with social media platforms, I don't know that you would discover anything about these guys that you don't already know, except you'd have some amazing television moments, maybe. Maybe that's not the best way to pick a president.
With them, though, not out and about as much. Yeah, there's a natural curiosity, I think, on my part to see sort of how they do. How do they sort of spar? How do they go back and forth? And what does that look like? And can one sort of get the other one to sort of commit to this policy or that platform, you know, that kind of thing? Because I think it's interesting when they are able to actually ask each other questions. But I think right now I do more than anything, I do want to see that, maybe more than baseball.
Yeah, but you want to see it because it's compelling television. You're not seeing it because you think it's going to help you as a voter, do you?
I want to understand them.
What don't you understand about Donald Trump that you would like? Later, for that matter, Joe.
I want to, because I am of the opinion, and I think there's a lot of science behind it, that voting, people vote in the moment. That candidates capture a moment. So I would like to see them. I think one of you mentioned, like, I'd like to see it close to the election. I would too, because I still think that there are plenty of people out there who are on the fence. I don't know what to do. These are these moments that people go with to vote. A lot of times it's gut instinct. So I want to understand that. I do think people want to hear from Biden. I think they want to hear from him more. And I think there's a whole raft of voters out there who think, hey, don't take me for granted. Don't take me for granted. Speak to me. And so I don't think that you can ignore that, because I do believe that that was sort of part of the issue in 2016. I think some voters felt taken for granted, like, oh, you know, I don't need to visit them. I don't need to see them. And so I think that this can only go on so long.
Biden is teed up to do pretty well on these debates, I think, because Trump has given him all kinds of material to work with. There's just not I think he's like I say, he's teed up to handle himself well. I'm not convinced that the person who performs best on the debate stage is going to be the best president. But I know that's something that it's part of our political folklore that this is the case. And so I'm fine with it. I just feel like Biden is probably doing himself a great favor, at least at this point, in just letting Trump talk and letting Trump go on and be interviewed by Axios and by Chris Wallace and babble on the way he does and say these crazy things he says at his hearings, at his briefings and so on. That, you know, every day he goes on and does that, more people are going like, is this guy up for the job? Is this what I want 4 more years of?
But on the other side of that is the question, is this president going to be accessible? Is he going to be around? Are we going to be able to ask questions of him? And when you don't have a candidate, and I'm not talking about Biden, there's plenty of other people doing it. When you don't hear from them, when you ask, and there have been plenty of reporters talking about it, I've asked for an interview. Chris Wallace was talking about it last Sunday. He said, we're going to bring it up every week that we asked the Biden campaign for equal time that we gave Trump. And every week that passes, when that doesn't happen, I think that's sort of, there's a measure of doubt that sets in. And
See, I think that's more of a risk. Those kind of interviews are more of a risk for Biden as they are a risk for Trump. Those are much harder than the debates. The debates tend to be these kind of are very stylized, and they're kind of like joint news conferences sometimes, where someone will, you get 90 seconds and then you get 60 seconds to respond. And if you're any good at all at filibustering or changing the topic or answering the question that you wish you were asked, then it moves on so the next person gets a question. And so I think a debate format is not nearly as good as these one-on-one interviews, where, and one of the things that Lisa, you mentioned earlier, and I think is really true, which is that both of those interviews, particularly the one from Axios, were like clinics in how to keep following up on a question and not allow someone to dodge a question or change the subject on you. That both interviewers kept coming back, like, well, wait a minute, you said this, and they bring it back. That doesn't happen in debates. So a debate format is. I mean, you can look like you're being really brave by debating, but someone, you know, like Biden or Trump, either of those guys, can control themselves, control the situation much better in a debate format than they can in one of these one-on-one interviews. So the fact that Biden is ducking those is much more telling than the fact that he's ducking. I'm not even sure that he's ducking debates. I haven't heard any real.
But he's been kind of invisible.
The larger point is we're not hearing from him, and so at any stage, I just want to hear from him. I want to see him. I think that I speak for a lot of voters. You just want to hear, even if it's your person, you want to hear from them.
Isn't John's question, though, who is it out there right now who is undecided between Trump and Biden? Are there really a lot of people who are like that? Because it's hard to believe. you would like, well,
there are people. Yes.
I mean,
I can down my block and count the houses. Yes.
How can you be undecided between those two completely divergent visions and personalities? And I just don't understand how you could possibly.
Well, if you grew up as a Republican and you feel like you're sort of abandoning ship, it might be a difficult choice. I don't know. If you feel like, okay, my dad was a Republican, we voted straight party line, and I've always voted straight party line, and now you're rethinking things. I don't know. And there's another side of it too, where I'm still hearing these sort of echoes of Bernie Sanders, like there's nobody good to vote for. You know, I don't want Biden. That's not what I want. The Democratic Party's, you know, screwed me over. And so I give up.
I think the debates would be different too, because it wouldn't be a crowd. It wouldn't be an arena full of people cheering on Donald Trump's bragging about the size of his member. You know, that the stuff that in debates for Donald Trump were working well because he was just playing to the crowd and scoring points. You're not going to have the laugh track anymore. It might be kind of dry, a debate between these two guys.
But it also might be more honest, you know?
I don't like the... I don't think there should be a crowd at those things. Yeah.
I totally agree, John. The second time in the podcast that I totally agree with you. I don't think there should be... Why should there ever be an audience for a debate like that, a serious policy debate? Who cares what the people, you know, who can pack the audience with enough cheers or who can generate laughs? The big decisions that you make as a leader like that are not made in front of a crowd. They're made in tough conversations. So
we've been talking for an hour and you've agreed with me twice.
I know it's not going to happen again.
Well, then we'll wrap it up now. We are all done. Lisa, nice to see you and hear you. And Erica, somewhat the same. Steve Bertrand had to exit, but thanks, guys. It's nice to hear you.
Good to see you and hear you, too.
Talk to you soon, John. Yeah.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.